are some of the challenges you run up against in terms of promising in congregational life? Where do you see the difficulties in terms of making commitments, making promises, keeping commitments? Where are the challenges, and what's the source of them?
I think we were discussing this. It seems like the source is community. We don't have the community, so we don't have that commitment to each other. So it's more about me. So I come into that, and it's how things are working for me. Whereas I feel like my generation, it used to be you were there, you were committed, you promised. It's like a family. You're not going to walk away from it unless God leaves you. So we don't have that community, that sense of community anymore.
And I think actually that gets at a variety of things. I'm not sure we can do all of them, but part of it is a change in the understanding of sort of how we morally evaluate things. It used to be that a lot of times we did things because promising depends on some version of seeing it as a duty or an obligation. If I made a promise, then part of my integrity is to keep it. So it's either sort of duty or virtue in ethics language. I think because we're so pragmatic today and utilitarian, I mean, it's like promising kind of fails if you're continually wondering whether or not that promise is really the best decision, whether I ought to reconsider, maybe I made a promise, but really something better came along. Mm-hmm. At which point, the whole structure, the whole practice of promising fails. So I think we're actually up against a very major cultural challenge in terms of a total shift in how we do moral reasoning, which is much more oriented toward pragmatic calculation. So what we might call some version of individual expressivism, sort of what's good for me and what's the bottom line. And those are not good for promising. Mostly we just then are continually reevaluating with the promises, whether it's worth it to keep the promise. So I think that seeps in. I don't think people explicitly think about what's going on, but I think that seeps into congregational life just like it does into every other kind of promising.
I'm just wondering if we as leaders are partly responsible for this, especially in the evangelical and often non-denominational churches. Creeds have all but disappeared. We're not used to saying we believe this anymore. We don't have, many of us don't have membership classes where, yes, I am this. And I wonder if we've given up too much ground and perhaps led the way in people not understanding the concept of keeping your promise even when it hurts kind of thing.
Well, I think that's true. I think we've wanted to make it very easy to bring people in. Mm-hmm. And so we really very rarely talk about the cost of discipleship, the cost of following Christ. And so we're quite unprepared to keep promises because we never realized there were very many promises involved.
Well, I think even in our culture, I mean, outside of Christianity, it's just, when talking with young people as they're going into undergrad, I mean, it's, show me an incoming freshman that knows what they want their major to be and they actually keep it all the way through. Seriously. And so, you know, even parents with their middle and high school students, you know, it's like, you know, they want their kids to experience lots of different things, but, you know, we need to keep our options open.
That's exactly
and,
right.
And so, you know, just having to, coming up with the concept of, you know, you're going to get your greatest fulfillment from making and keeping significant,
right,
you know, commitments, that's just really, it's really countercultural.
It's very difficult, and I think you've hit on both of them. One is that we're a culture that celebrates choice, and keeping our options open. It makes it very hard to make promises.
Right.
When you make a promise, you foreclose certain options. Mm-hmm. That's the reality, and opportunities. And I think that's why it's hard for people to commit to marriage. But it's hard for them to commit to a project, or a church, or a congregation. In a sense, everything becomes a version of shopping for the best deal.
Right.
And that's true about a mate. I mean, you can hear it sometimes. And, you know, shopping for a congregation or a house. And what happens also is that people keep postponing the decision just in case something better is kind of around the corner. And so that's part of what you see with kids in terms of not being able to commit to a major or anything like that. And, you know, in some ways we want people to have an experience of choice. It plays out in so many things. You can see it with people putting off all sorts of decisions, and even little decisions, like whether or not you're going to go to an event. I mean, think about trying to schedule stuff for church or things, but or think about how hard it is, even if you're doing a wedding, to get people to commit to coming. And that's facilitated by online invitations where you can respond, maybe. It's like, maybe you'll come. Or also you can check who's coming to decide whether or not it's a good decision for you. So everyone and everything becomes more tentative. I really saw this even as I was working on this big conference at Asbury annually over the course of about 20 years, how increasingly difficult it became to get people to commit to doing things. Everybody would be there on the last 2 days to help out. But the project itself was like a 2-month planning period. We could not get a group of people toward the end. In the beginning of it, we had like 30 people who would commit to the whole period. By the end, almost nobody would commit to that period because there might be other things that came along. And I realized we still got it done because they came through in the last 2 days. But it's a very different way of planning. It allows more spontaneity. but you also quickly have the feeling that each person is waiting to make sure that he or she has the full range of options before they make the choice. And I think, ironically, an endless array of options is not necessarily good for us. Not always. We're finite. And it actually helps to have some limitations on the options. And again, I'm not arguing that people don't need options. Of course they do. Yeah.
Just a two-part question. First one, just my own curiosity. Do you make a difference between commitment and promise? Is there any cultural nuances behind the two terms? And the second one is that, going back to Mark's question, do you see gap year as a phenomenon of reflection of choices? That the high schooler is now taking a gap year before they hit in the university?
The prolonged adolescence or whatever.
or having fun being a barista at Starbucks. If there's any fun at all.
I think there are a lot of current phenomena that represent an uncertainty about how we're going to make choices. In terms of your first question about whether promising and commitments are the same thing, I think commitments can be a more general kind of statement of valuing and so on. Promises, for me anyway, strike me as a little bit more, not necessarily formal, but more understood, oftentimes bilaterally, between persons or between parties. Commitments you can hold more generally.
Yeah, the struggle I have is that I, just personally speaking, really limited experience. I have seldom heard people talking about making a promise.
Right. That's what I was saying early on, that actually promising is not talked about in theological circles. And I think what was interesting to me as I read the philosophical literature is that they have kind of parsed out the difficulties. In fact, they talk about conditions that defeat a promise. Which is a great line, right? Conditions that defeat a promise. But they're all the reasons that promises fail. And as I read them, I thought, churches should know about this, you know, but it doesn't end up in that literature. And so I think you're right that most of the time we don't talk about promises. We talk about commitments, right, and fidelity and so on. But the promises are more particularized, I think, usually. Scripture talks about promises and covenants. Mm-hmm. But I don't think in everyday life we have reflected on it as much as we could.
That's so weird that it's not alive and well in the church because, you know, the metaphor for God living his cosmos and Christ living his church is marriage, which is a promise.
But we'll talk about it as a covenant, right?
Yeah.
And I think people don't necessarily connect covenants and promises.
Within the practical. You will use the verbiage of
promising.
Yeah.
And so I think that, yeah, promises, vows, and stuff are in a sense the structures of fidelity. But we're much more used to talking about fidelity and covenant. One of the other reasons that we struggle, I think, with promises is that we know that situations, this is one of the conditions that defeat a promise, so we know that situations, some circumstances will change. And we're afraid to make commitments that bind us to a particular future. And I think that life together can become very fragile if, for one thing, we want to keep our options open, and for two, we're always concerned about what's going to be best for us. What we always wanting better and fuller experiences. So we sort of are very uncomfortable with committing to anything. So the cultural emphasis both on freedom and on self-fulfillment make promising more difficult as a practice. But also, and this is one of the main reasons promises fail, is we don't make promises in a vacuum. We make promises in the midst of other commitments and other promises. And so we struggle with conflicting commitments, frailty and finitude, and that's when philosophers talk about conditions that defeat a promise. Sometimes you can't fulfill it. Sometimes the meaning of the promise changes. Sometimes the circumstances change so much so that the promise itself becomes meaningless, and so on. So there are a number, but not all conflicts run so deep that they endanger the relationship or the community. I mean, there's oftentimes forgiveness. I mean, there's confession, recognition that we can't fulfill a promise, and then forgiveness, and we move on. But sorting out fidelity, how to be faithful in messy situations, is hard. And so it's important to become more attentive to the promises that we do make and how we can keep them, and when necessary, how we redeem broken promises. Even when we're justified in not keeping a commitment, so even when we can't keep a promise. So the classic one, W.B. Ross, is that you've made a promise to go walking. It's pretty funny given my ankle. You've made a promise to go walking with a friend. That assumes that you're able to go walking with a friend. You never spell that out. You don't say to the person, well, I'll do it tomorrow with you if I can walk, because you never, right? But it's a condition, if you sprain your ankle or whatever, you can't do it. So it's a condition that defeats a promise. So then we have to figure out how, that's a simple one, but how you redeem the broken ones. Even when you're justified in not keeping a commitment, the promise that we've made still obligates us in some way. Now that's a moral claim that I'll make. If you're doing full utilitarian kind of reflection, you can't keep a promise because something better comes along, well then that's the moral decision. I don't think that's true. I think promises actually continue to obligate us even when we can't. You can't fulfill it, but you can apologize. You can try to, Aquinas talks about trying to find a way to fulfill it that would look different, but it's still, it's a recognition that the promise represents something in a relationship that still needs to be attended to, even if it's in a different framework. I think sometimes we're also wary of promising because there can be lots of distortions and deformations in promise making and promise keeping. We can be faithful to the wrong things. Think about the distortions in something like gang loyalties. They're very strong structures of promising. It's just that the promise itself, the end of the promise is problematic. The content or the objects of fidelity or promises are wrong. So it's not just about making and keeping them. It's making sure that the content, what we're promising, the content of the promise matters. I think sometimes we also struggle with fidelity and faithfulness to persons because we simultaneously care for them and disapprove of what they're doing. This is one that hits home oftentimes in families, right? We struggle with the question of whether remaining faithful, in a sense, keeping at least the implicit promises we've made to family members or whatever, whether remaining faithful to them means we approve of what they're doing. And this, I think, is an extremely difficult question. In other and quite difficult situations, and some of you all I know are living through this one, we make promises to a community or church or school. The community itself shifts in significant ways. Mm-hmm. So you've made vows sometimes to a denomination or whatever, and then the denomination itself moves. And sometimes the shift is because of drift or infidelity. Sometimes it's because the community is correcting previous wrong beliefs or commitments and so on. But what do you do with personal vows or promises to a community when that community itself makes fundamental changes in its commitments and still expects loyalty? And I think this is a place of great difficulty. It's a complicated question. because you can't necessarily fulfill both, because the content of the vow itself precludes that. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, as I've talked to some pastors in which there's been significant denominational shifts, that's just extremely difficult when you have vowed to be faithful to certain things and you feel as if your community actually has moved. It's very difficult. There are hard issues in promise keeping and for communities. I think when we're on the receiving end of failed promises and we don't see a justification, we experience betrayal. Our deepest betrayals are tied to the most significant relationships. Betrayal is devastating to trust and to our sense of justice, sometimes to our faith, because it tears at the fabric of human life and relationships. We don't tend to talk about betrayal within community very much or recognize just how destructive it is. We hesitate to call small betrayals sin, but when people betray confidences, or when they abandon the promises they've made to people, to other people, we end up eroding community and contributing to a deep climate of distrust. Sometimes it can be a series of small betrayals. They erode trust and confidence. Other times it's one big betrayal. Think about the terrible fallout from clergy misconduct. I mean, that is just one gigantic betrayal. It's a profound form of betrayal of the promises made to that, the role to the community and so on. When persons misuse power or engage in sexual or financial misconduct, the impact is far-reaching. It's way more than the immediate people involved, right? I mean, all of you have done cleanup from these kinds of things, I'm sure. But it affects the family, it affects the church, sometimes it even affects the larger community. Everybody's wounded, and oftentimes, you know, for the people closest to it, there's also a sense of deep betrayal by God. Their sense of confidence in the church, in the institution, in God is really damaged. And a lot of those betrayals are dependent on small deceptions and secrecy. If you think about how often secrecy and deception accompany betrayal, and that makes you realize just how much promise breaking is tied to deception. So the promising and truthfulness together. And when there's deception involved in betrayal, it leaves a very deep wound. It's hard to heal. So betrayal is devastating. What makes it more complicated is that the gospel itself does not suggest that a life of faithfulness, love, and service protects us from disappointments or betrayal and failure. In fact, it's pretty clear that in the cross we see the bearing of deep betrayals and failures. So that as leaders and communities, we're ever in need of figuring out ways to redeem the broken promises, to redeem the betrayals, and help people recover from failures in commitments. And it's impossible to do this without a deep dependence on grace and forgiveness. Some of our commitments are not made to persons, but involve commitment or fidelity to historic traditions. This is sort of circling back a little bit to what I was saying before, or commitments to particular beliefs. And when our fundamental commitments are challenged, the entire structuring of our lives can seem at risk. Christians who disagree over matters of theological or moral significance can turn on one another with extraordinary fierceness. Anybody seen this one? Communities, not to mention individuals, do not always handle disagreements well, especially when they're related to important beliefs or commitments. And it's ironic because we're committed to a faith that's centered in love and a crucified Savior. But our attacks on brothers and sisters with whom we disagree are really very troubling. We are, in a sense, undone by our strengths. At least sometimes we take our deepest commitments seriously. I mean, that's part of the challenge, right? We actually do oftentimes take our commitments seriously and our promises. So the fidelity, though, doesn't always guide us in how to disagree or how to seek solution to the disagreement. And theological and moral disagreements are often made personal and interpreted as betrayal. And any of you who have survived some of the denominational splits over the last years know that the language of betrayal and is just very prominent. It's impossible to sustain community if people are not willing to stay in the conversation or at the table during times of significant disagreement. Our inclination may be to shut down or to shut out those who challenge us at important places, but you can't find resolution if you don't stay with the relationship, at least for the time it takes to understand what the differences are. Some differences may run so deep, I think, that they do affect fundamental identity and communal purposes. But often people sever the relationships before they fully understand what the other group of people or whatever are arguing, what the disagreements are or their significance. And this is important to me because I have survived I've been in multiple communities where there have been major meltdowns. Some of them have been theological differences. Oftentimes they've been personal also, sometimes over leadership kinds of differences and so on, where there are big issues. I think quite often they end up being a combination of theological differences as well as sort of played out in personal identities. But the ones that involve whole communities, oftentimes those disagreements take on a life of their own. And in the midst of one major meltdown, I suddenly had this image of the biblical image of devouring came to mind. And you know, scripture uses the image of devouring in a number of different places. It describes the devil, our adversary, prowling in search of someone to devour in 1 Peter. Of the rich and powerful devouring the poor in the Gospels. And then Paul writes to the Christians in Galatia that if they continue to bite and devour one another, they may find themselves consumed. That's what he says in Galatians 5. But in church and community fights, I think sometimes the language of devouring is miserably appropriate. Our commitment really, in a very perverse way, our commitment to feeding on Jesus as the bread of life is replaced by sort of a frenzy of devouring one another. In efforts to gain the upper hand or to hold onto resources for the kingdom or to win the theological argument or moral argument, sometimes we lose sight of our larger fidelities to Christ and to holiness and to love. And here I am not suggesting that Christians should never disagree robustly. I think we should. I think that's an expression of faithfulness, actually. And I'm certainly not arguing that tolerance should be our highest value. Good arguments shaped by love and truthfulness and fidelity can build community and deepen maturity and faithfulness. And efforts to understand alternate viewpoints before we dismiss them are acts of respect. And challenging one another on important commitments and loyalties can be evidence of love and faithfulness and a desire for deeper unity. So sometimes differences are significant enough that they represent alternative or incompatible visions. And a decision to move forward separately may be necessary. Nevertheless, how we deal with the people with whom we disagree on important matters reveals our own deepest commitments. Jesus, as John tells us, loved his disciples to the end and instructed them to follow him, follow his example of love and sacrificial servanthood. So we're called to love one another in the same way, not by sugarcoating the truth or by avoiding difficult disagreements, but we are never released from the call to love, to love fully and completely. That's really our identity as Christians.
Do you have an idea of why conflict and the tools of conflict resolution are just so absent in the church? I just have felt and heard and talked to people where if conflict is present, then there's something wrong with you as a Christian.
Right.
You know, because we're Christians living in community, then everything's supposed to be happy, happy, joy, joy, and if conflict arises, then something's wrong with your faith. Let's get to the bottom of why you're such a sinner, as opposed to just realizing that it is going to be there because we are still in that tension between, you know, justification and sanctification, and how we might be able to better model that. awareness, I guess, that...
It seems to me that part of the difficulty is that the commitments that we hold are significant commitments. And so we hold them pretty intensely. Now, I think they sometimes get packaged in ways that sort of, we highlight one commitment within a whole set of commitments of faith, and we make that the litmus test. And that makes things complicated. But then I think also, because really, for the most part, we have imagined, and this may not be true of the whole church, but it certainly is true of the American church, we don't resolve conflict because we don't acknowledge that we can disagree. There's not a lot of attention to the skills that we would need to really kind of stay in prolonged conversation together. Mm-hmm. How we can begin to really listen to one another. I think that is made worse by sort of a soundbite culture, where people do very facile, very fast analyses, and you know, whoever has the best soundbite wins. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of, you know, you pick small pieces, and then you make that the representation of the whole of faith or something.